Welcome back to the Midwife's Cauldron, and we are very glad to have you here as always. On today's episode, Rachel is going to interview me, and we are talking all things breastfeeding. Of course, it's my favourite. So get yourself a cup of tea, start the car, or put the headphones in and go for a walk, because you're in for a treat. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host.
Today, Katie, we are talking all things getting breastfeeding started. So the early days, because we've had listeners asking questions and we're going to put it all into a podcast. So let's get started. Give us the number one tip. Well, let's start right from the kind of beginning. What is the best possible thing to do to start off on the best foot with breastfeeding? If there's one tip, if there's one big thing, what would it be?
Oh, yeah. Start with an easy question. Good. That's great. Skin to skin contact. Totally. It's the easiest thing. Try and keep your hands off after birth and encourage skin to skin contact. But I think the biggest thing is to not see it as a one-off or just in that first 24 hours. This needs to be encouraged to mums, because, you know, as soon as that first sort of 24 hours is over, we're dressing them, and then it seems to feel like to parents that we are making the babies uncomfortable. Because of course, when you undress them or you change their nappy, they scream because, hold on, I was really warm and now I'm freezing. So we have to sort of explain why skin to skin contact is so important. And I think, you know, like with so many things in the postnatal phase, it has to be repeated. It's something that is absolutely imperative to start that first feed. And if for whatever reason they're not feeding well or at all in the beginning, because of the birth or because of maybe epidural or opiates on board during labor, then leaving them in skin to skin contact safely is so important. And it's the number one tip I would give to every single mum and every single person working within that postnatal sphere. And the other thing is, you know, we talk about keeping hands off, but I think another tip for us when we work, and some people are going to hate me, but is not wear perfume, because the baby sense of smell is really heightened. And sometimes as midwives, we have to go and we have to pick the baby up or help the mom, say if she's had a C-section. And if that baby's nestled by our neck and smelling the perfume, it can then go transfer onto them. And then they get sort of confusion when they're coming to the breast. And we really want them to use those innate reflexes that as humans we're born with. So I'm so sorry. I'm stopping everyone ever wearing perfume. I stopped a long time ago. I've got one bottle that I think I've had for maybe 10 years and just so rarely use it. I'm sure it's off now.
I was going to say, then I've got a best before date.
I don't think they do that, but yeah, maybe. I'm not sure how I smell when I think, oh, I might have a spritz.
So does that apply to essential oils and all of that business as well?
Yeah, any smells. So, you know, I'm much more of a natural girl these days, but any heavy smell. I mean, I used to teach baby massage, and you know, there's so many baby specific natural oils on the market as well that, but they have a scent, and you don't want a scent. And even when I was teaching, I would be specific about getting, you know, an olive oil or a sunflower oil or something else or coconut oil, but you just want something that isn't highly scented. So extra virgin olive oil is not great, because it's you smell like a salad. And this is obviously at 5-6 weeks down the track when you're going to start doing baby massage with bubbas. But Yeah, you want to be really cautious. And then same with mums, same with partners. Like if you've got a really stinky deodorant, that shouldn't, those two words shouldn't go together, but like a highly scented deodorant, or you're a perfume lover, absolutely avoid, particularly in those first few weeks. That baby needs to know your smell and doesn't need to be confused. You're, you know, around the areola, you've got Montgomery's tubercles, the little bumps.
I love that word.
So do I. It's not only Montgomery, which is brilliant. Oh my God, if I get a dog, I'm going to call it Montgomery's tubercles.
Yeah, but hang on, because it probably is named after a man.
It is. Of course it is. Do you know about...
Well, I don't think a man should be naming bits of our anatomy.
Maybe I'll just call it tubercles. Tubercles!
Yes, it's the tubercles. Tubercles is cool.
Tubercles. Yes, it was named after a man. The whole breast anatomy is a whole nother fascinating thing. Do you know how we came about the breast anatomy? Because it's a really interesting story, and it goes back to the 1840s. And there was a London doctor called Sir Astley Cooper. And he was a doctor who wanted to investigate the lactating breast. And really no one had been able to look inside. So he took cadavers, goodness knows how, in the 1840s, maybe grave robbers, of lactating or nursing mums who had passed away. And he dissected the breast, and with the help of his friend, who was an artist, he actually laid out the breast tissue, and he used different coloured wax and injected the warm or the hot wax through the ductal system. And then he laid out the breast in these segments on a big round stone, and his friend drew that image. And
wow,
this was the image that then got put into textbooks, until there was research done in 2005 by Donna Geddes. She was known as Donna Ramsey then, at the University of Western Australia. And we had more better ultrasounds.
More better.
And she started to go, I'm not really seeing these things, which we've called lactiferous sinuses, which are the sinuses like a pouch. So we used to think that just behind the nipple, there were these sort of bigger portions in the duct system. It was like a pouch, and that's where the milk was stored. So we used to think the milk was made in the cells, traveled down the ducts, and was stored in the sinuses. And then the baby would have to use a compression.
You still see drawings of that?
You do. And it absolutely shouldn't happen, because there's been enough research to show that it's not that they don't exist, they never were there. Because if you imagine when you have hot wax, what happens to it? It cools. And what had happened was the pooling of the hot wax had stretched the duct. And so it made these sinuses. Yeah.
That weren't there.
They don't exist. It was just made by a man, Sir Astley Cooper, who was trying to look at the breast. The other thing is, not only did we believe there were sinuses, so actually the milk doesn't get stored in the sinuses. It's made in the cell and it's held in the cell. And that's why when you have the cell, it's covered in that myoepithelial smooth muscle, the same as the uterus, same muscle that makes contractions. That is responsible for the milk ejection reflex, because it squeezes the milk cell under the influence of oxytocin, and pushes the milk down. That's what a milk letdown is, or a milk ejection reflex, in response to the baby suckling.
And this wasn't just breasts, was it? Because, you know, in the early drawings of birth, so where a lot of our textbooks get their pictures of babies in the uterus during labor and you know, the torso, that comes directly from actual torsos of women in the 1700s, 1800s that were drawn. So they were using dead women and babies to learn about how birth works, which is a dynamic, moving. We're obviously doing the same with breasts, which is looking at dead breast tissue and then trying to work out how it would function in a living, you know, woman with all kinds of hormonal interplay going on with the anatomy.
Absolutely. And the other thing we see is when you see those textbook images, the breast tissue is set out like, you know, often it's called petals or the petals of the breast, and it's set out really symmetrically. Well, no shit, Sherlock. Mm. It's not like that. It's an absolute web of mass of ducts interacting and all underneath each other. And then the breast tissue is just all dotted around. And we've got two types of fat in the breast. That's why we, you know, our breasts get bigger and smaller if we gain or lose weight often. We have these ligaments named after a man, Cooper's ligaments, Sir Astley Cooper, that hold the breast up or not, because we all have different sizes and shapes. But so what happened was when they started to ultrasound the breast, they found that so much was so different. Yeah, it was 2005. We were taught in those textbooks the wrong anatomy of the breast. And you are quite right. When I had to, you have to resit your IBCLC exam every 10 years and you have to update every 5 years. When I resat the exam, I think it was, oh, it's 5 years ago because I've got to resit. I sent off for one new book, and because I wanted to update and all the other stuff I had at work, and I came across the anatomy and it was old and I went apeshit. And lots of my colleagues have bought this book as well who are resitting, and I wrote them a letter and they just said, oh no, we're not going to give you your money back. And I said, how can I trust your book when you've got this out of date that I'm aware of? What about something I'm reading that I don't know is out of date information? And so they gave us all our money back. So
you troublemaker, Katie.
I was a troublemaker. I was like, no bloody way am I accepting old anatomy that at this point is 10 years old. So
and incorrect.
And
I'm
going
to have to go and dig about in my books now. Yeah, I still see it. Like when I'm trying to remember even seeing an image that wasn't that, like where would we get an updated image?
Yep. And so can you imagine in terms of not just lactation, but surgery, anything we do on the breast, we had limited anatomy. Obviously we had other ultrasounds and other more in depth than just a drawing. You're not getting breast surgeons go, I remember this cartoon drawing in my book, I will cut here. They are obviously more in depth. But the reason why it also makes a difference is that the same team in Western Australia, not only ultrasound did, that's not a word, is it? They did ultrasounds.
Ultrasounded.
They ultrasounded the woman's breasts and they went, oh, it's different. They also ultrasounded the baby sucking. And so because you used to talk about babies having this like peristaltic wave movement, oh God, I've really gotten proper. I don't even know. I don't think I even exist, my accent. I don't want to label anyone with subtitles. That type of accent. It's just me. Someone on Instagram did say, they were from Canada though, so they're probably going to hear this, that they thought I sounded like one of the announcers in between shows on the BBC. And I told her it's because I'm so posh. She's clearly
You're not
British.
Posh.
I'm not posh at all.
Nope.
Anyway.
The peristalsis.
The peristalsis. So this is the wave movement.
I was taught that.
I know, all were. We still hear it. So the tongue would do this wave motion. And the point of that was that the tongue was compressing the areola because that's where the milk sat. So it would compress the lactiferous sinuses to draw the milk out.
Mm.
But there aren't any lactiferous sinuses. So why would the baby need to do that?
All wrong.
So the babies, actually, when we ultrasound them, their tongue, the front and middle of their tongue, just raises and goes down. And what happens is as it goes down, it creates a higher vacuum level. And so babies are creating vacuum at the breast to draw the milk out. That the mum, so the mum has to have an effective milk ejection and the baby then draws the milk out. So we see at the beginning when there's milk, when there's larger volumes of milk there, not so much in the first couple of days with the colostrum, that the sucking pattern changes. So they start off with these really rapid, what we call non-nutritive sucks, that's stimulating an oxytocin release, milk ejection, and then they change into this more like suck, swallow, suck, suck, swallow, suck, swallow, because the milk's flowing, nutritive sucking. So, yeah.
So they're not actually milking the breast with the tongue.
They're not milking the breast.
Which is the story that is told. Yeah.
It's perpetuated all the time. And like you would see bottles and teats advertised as peristaltic teats and things. Why? And dummies, peristaltic, like it's, but it still exists because we're perpetuating this myth, but it's not supported by the evidence. So there you go, bit of history.
Awesome. So when does the milk change? So when, because obviously there's colostrum, how is it different for the baby in terms of feeding colostrum and then moving into milk? What shifts and differences will the baby experience and then the woman in terms of the pattern of breastfeeding?
I think another important thing is, I'm going to go back, that a lot of people don't know, is that during pregnancy, you're actually producing milk from around 16 weeks of pregnancy. And so because you've got progesterone pumping through, it actually makes sure that you don't suddenly produce massive, large quantities of milk. So you're producing colostrum. And then what happens is, once the baby has been born and then the placenta has come out, then the body knows you're no longer pregnant. So you have this rapid decline in progesterone and estrogen, and it allows for prolactin to increase. And that's what kickstarts everything. So progesterone and estrogen in pregnancy are developing the breast tissue. And then afterwards, you've got this activation, also known as lactogenesis 2, or secretory activations, kicks in around about 30 to 72 hours after birth, if everything's gone normal. And so you're getting the first milk, which is colostrum. And I've got a real bugbear that we sort of call it, in a way, colostrum, and then we sort of say when your milk comes in. I think it's really a misnomer, because the milk is there. It's just a different type of milk, and it's just the volume that increases. So what's happening is there's small volumes of colostrum that is highly powerful, packed full of glucose to just support the brain, but not to overload the baby. And it's more of a like first immunization, like it's just packed full of protective factors. It's thick, it's like honey. You know, if you've ever hand expressed or seen someone do that or put someone on the pump in the first few days, you're getting, for most women, tiny amounts, like coming out drop by drop. It's not flowing, and you're not having big squirts of milk. You're not seeing babies gulping. But around about 30 to 72 hours, because you've had that exchange of hormones, the milk volume will increase. And so the milk will come in, or the milk volumes will start to gradually increase. And so you have this transition between sort of colostrum into mature milk. And really the best way to see it is, well, if you're just breastfeeding, you won't see it. But if someone's pumping, you'll see that it probably the traditional color of colostrum is kind of yellowy. Then it goes to kind of less yellow, more white. And then when you get mature milk around about 2 to 4 weeks, then it looks very white, cloudy, and quite thin as well. And so it's changing in volume. It's changing in its glucose, carbohydrates, so its fat levels as well, to become this mature milk that's going to sustain this infant for as long, well, for 6 months exclusively.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
So in terms of that, so it's obviously really important for the baby to be initiating contact with the breast skin to skin and putting in their order, which you've talked about in previous podcasts about how important that early feeding is in order to put in the order for later on in the breastfeeding relationship. So what about the latching on? It seems to me that a lot of women, yes, fair enough, in hospital birth, where there's been lots of disruption of that early initiation of breastfeeding, there seems to be real problems around babies latching. Like that seems to be a big thing going on. What's that about? Why can't babies latch to a breast?
Several reasons, but yeah, it's so difficult as well. And it's really soul destroying, like plants the seed of doubt as well for mums. And I think when you're really busy on the ward, it's really bloody hard to try and deal with this. There's several reasons why they won't latch. Let's just take birth. The first sort of in-your-face reasons are probably going to be opiates and epidural. Now, the jury's not fully in with that, but we definitely see a trend in those infants who have had an epidural, opiates throughout the birth. They come out more sleepy, and so they're just sort of sleepy, and that's why they don't latch. The other issue is if you've had maybe a forceps or a ventouse, and the baby is, maybe their face is not that symmetrical. Because if you think about the molding that's happened, sometimes we can have babies where they're, you know, one side of the lip is a bit higher than the other. Now I'm just showing Rachel and speaking like that. And so that's why we need the YouTubes, exactly. Especially when I'm talking. So if they're a bit squished, and that just takes a couple of days to settle down for most babies. Then imagine if they're attaching and you have to create vacuum, but there's one part which is not quite fully symmetrical on the breast and there's a little gap. It's like having a hole in your straw. So maybe they're not able to create a good enough vacuum, and that's why they come on and off. Late preterm infants, and even we're seeing now these early term infants. So this is the group which we have always said are absolutely hunky-dory, 37 to just under 39 weeks. But Rachel's shaking her head, because we, you know, if you've been a midwife, particularly in the community, they're the ones where they've gone home after, say, 48 hours, and you've gone and seen them the next day, and those are the babies that are tango orange with jaundice, and you get to the door and a mum says, "Oh my God, my baby's such a good baby. Slept all night." And you're like, "Oh my God." Because these babies, sort of that 35, well, definitely and younger, but often 35 weeks, the baby would still be put on the postnatal maternity ward, not taken to the special care baby unit or the NICU. And these babies just don't have the sort of the same developmental ability as a full-term infant to maybe wake for feeds. So these are the babies that if you're wrapping them up like a little burrito and they're putting in the cot and they're not on skin to skin, we're going to miss those very short early feeding cues. And so they won't feed frequently enough. And then of course they don't have enough glucose on board, and then they get more sleepy, and it's a vicious cycle. So we can have.
And that's interesting, because we're inducing more and more women in that early term period.
Oh my God, yeah.
So we're going to see more and more of this, because people do just think, oh, 37 weeks, that's a term baby, no problem.
Yeah.
when, as you said, it hasn't finished developing. This individual baby has not reached the full development that it needs in order to breastfeed.
Yeah. And obviously, if there's a medical reason for induction early, that goes without saying. But to, yeah, we're bringing in those 38-week inductions where there maybe is a medical reason, but it's not an essential. And yeah, this is the largest. I mean, late preterms are the largest growing preterm group. But those early terms, it's fairly new research. And actually, it's something I would, you know, really want people to start investigating. There's a really good protocol from the ABM, Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine. It's number 10, I believe. And they talk about, and they updated it, I think 2016 or 2018. So not that recently. And it was all about the late preterm infant. And they suddenly included the early term infant in babies that need to be washed. So a mum who's come on the ward with a baby with that age, for me, is an alarm bell in the back of my head of, I need to watch this baby more closely. It's probably not going to be feeding well. And even if it is breastfeeding, it might not be effective or as vigorous or as long or transferring milk, or it sort of does a couple of minutes and then comes off and falls off and on. And those babies are risk factors for going home. Everyone thinks it's fine, but actually she's not been establishing a milk supply because she's not had the right amount of stimulation. And the baby then ends up sleepy, jaundiced, and we're in a vicious cycle of needing to supplement. I suppose other reasons for not attaching can be things like flat nipples or inverted nipples. And that can be that someone has flat nipples. There's a lot of women who have flattish nipples, but they have moldable tissue. And so that can be not a problem at all for the baby because the mum can be taught how to shape her areola and her breast tissue, that the baby then gets enough in their mouth and gets enough of that sort of feeling on their palate to start sucking. Inverted nipples, there's only really about 4%, 5%, we think, that are what we call true inverted. So that is, even with stimulation, they don't pop out. Those are tricky because often the baby wants some kind of sensation in their mouth to start them to suck. Not all. Some babies will latch on and you just think, wow, okay, I'm saying nothing because I thought you wouldn't. And that's great, amazing. But a lot of babies are like, it's almost, I imagine it, and this is not in the research, but it's a bit like the nipple presses that button between the hard and soft palate. And it's like, oh, there we go, start sucking. And so they need that stimulation. So they're probably the main reasons that babies won't attach. And also, I suppose, the comfort level, which we're thinking about mum's comfort, but sometimes babies will pull on and off, on and off. And what I'm looking at, and then I suddenly think, hey, this baby looks really uncomfortable, like its arms bent here and the other one's here. And so it's these minor movements of saying to the mum, how do you feel if we change this position? Have a go at that. How does that feel for you? Bring your arm around here, or just looking, is the baby comfy? And then that offer makes a huge difference. And the baby just suddenly goes, oh, thank God, and just stays on the breast because it's not going, oh, my leg's a bit twisted, or oh, my shoulder. And so changing the position can be something really simple and keep them on.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons it's really helpful to know how this baby was born. And if there's something like a shoulder dystocia, what side was it on? You know, because that shoulder might be sore. You know, how did that baby come out? Might that have caused some, you know, transient trauma that in their body that they're not going to feel comfortable in a particular position?
Absolutely. I completely agree. And yeah, so it's looking at that and thinking about what's happening with the head shape, the face shape. It's doing a total look at a baby, not just sort of checking the mouth and the eyes and all the things that we check. Do a full check of how that baby's looking, sitting. That will be a lactation check.
Do you want another question?
Yeah. No, we're finished. Thank you.
Thank you and good night. Bring me sunshine. I guess the latching on thing leads on to the next thing, which is sore nipples. That's another big issue that women report, having sore nipples. And sometimes, I mean, we talk about sore nipples, sometimes it looks like a massacre has gone on.
Yeah. Thanks for that.
And
imagery.
I'm guessing that's about latching.
Mostly. There is a difference between soreness that's reported and damage. So depending on the studies that you read, it's anywhere from maybe almost 30% to almost 80% that are reporting soreness in the first week.
So this is the thing. What's soreness? Because we're told breastfeeding shouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
So there can be an expectation that if you're doing it right, it will be entirely comfortable right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Is that true?
For some women it is, but for most women, as we can see from the research, it's not. And, you know, there's several reasons for that. One is, most women, if they've never breastfed before, probably haven't had someone suck on their breast and nipple 8 to 15 times a day for 3 days. So
I don't know. Some might.
Some might. Absolutely. I'm not closing the doors on that. But I would imagine the majority haven't had the time, to be honest. It's more of a time factor. Also, the vigorousness.
Do you know what I was told to do when I was pregnant? I was told not to do that. I was told to get a rough towel. This is true.
I know.
And rough up my nipples, like after having a shower and things, with a rough towel to prepare them for breastfeeding.
Yeah.
I was so looking forward to breastfeeding.
Did you do it?
Nope.
Good. We used to tell people to use like scrubbing brushes as well on their nipples, you know, like brush. I mean, that wasn't in my day, but you know, we're talking still early 90s, probably 80s. And also people will hear it from their parents or grandparents to prepare the nipples.
Then they wonder why in the UK nobody starts breastfeeding. Like,
yeah, I mean, start them off
in order to prepare, you need to scrub your nipples. Right there is, you know, no thanks.
I might give this a miss. Thanks very much. We're not doing that anymore, thank God, because guess what? The research said it doesn't help. No brainer.
Imagine that.
Oh, those women who, you know, don't have access to hard scrubbing brushes in the world that go, oh my God, I can't breastfeed. Don't think so. So, yeah, the UK has the worst. Actually, what am I talking about? Sore nipples.
We were talking about sore nipples, but actually I think that's a good point to make, is that, you know, that whether women breastfeed and how they breastfeed is obviously cultural and about, you know, what's happening around them. And what I noticed, and I'm sure you did as well, is from the UK, so, you know, we're talking about in the 90s now, late 90s, like nobody, breastfeeding was rare in the group of women that I cared for. It was really unusual. Women didn't breastfeed. They didn't start breastfeeding. They didn't want to start. So they started out with, I'm not going to breastfeed. Here's my bottles. Don't even talk to me about it. Even though you'd say, well, I'm going to talk to you anyway, because I need to share with you this information. You can put your hands over your ears if you want. So I just didn't look after many women who were breastfeeding. And then came over here and it was the absolute flip side. In the hospital, it was like a big deal when a woman came in who wasn't planning to breastfeed, because breastfeeding was just the norm. And it was kind of, oh, this woman, you know, the woman there isn't breastfeeding, and she's brought her own formula, and there was a big clot on to help her support her setting up her formula. Whereas in the UK, these little ready-made bottles that you just gave to women on their tray and they fed their babies. So it was a completely different culture. But then in Australia, women don't carry on breastfeeding, do they?
Yeah.
So the intention to start is there, but it fades off. And why is that?
And so this is what we're seeing. Say if we just take the US, UK, Germany, Australia, we're actually seeing initiation rates have massively increased in the UK now. So, you know, the work that's been done is you're sitting somewhere around, let's say, between 75 and 95% in these countries of initiation rate. So nearly all women want to breastfeed in these high-income countries. Then what we see is massive, massive tail-off of exclusive breastfeeding in that first 4 weeks. And the biggest reason for that is low milk supply and sore or damaged nipples. After that first 4 weeks, the biggest reason for drop-off is low milk supply or perceived low milk supply.
And I was going to say, what is there's perceived low milk supply.
Yeah.
But often women think they have low milk supply and when they actually don't.
And that's exactly the point, is that comes in with cultural and what's gone before. And if we take the UK for an example, we have not had many generations that have breastfed, because when the Second World War came around, women had to go to work really for the first time at a young age when they were having babies because their partners had gone off to war. The government actually introduced national formula so to help the women go to work. So we had an institutional formula feeding culture back from, you know, our grandparents and people who are birthing now, their great grandparents. So it's only really this generation, the last generation, so probably women in the last 15, 20 years, we really see this change in women wanting to breastfeed, or a bigger number. But possibly their parents and their grandparents and the people surrounding them either haven't breastfed at all, or they've not breastfed for long. And so society is not very accepting of breastfeeding in public, of breastfeeding full stop. And society's knowledge is that babies feed on a bottle and they sleep for 4 hours. Now, a breastfed baby doesn't do that. And we know that babies between 1 and 6 months will feed anywhere from 4 to 13 times. The 4 and the 13 were the outliers. So we're looking really at probably on average 6 to 12 times in 24 hours. So if you've got a baby who's feeding 10 to 12 times and is 3 months old or 2 months old, you are guaranteed to be getting comments like, are you feeding that baby again? God, that baby must be starving. I think you need to have some, give it some solids, or you need to get some formula down because you're just starving that kid. When this huge, massively thighed, beautiful bubba who's meeting all its milestones and thriving, or even if it's not huge, but it's thriving on the milestones and the growth charts that are right for that genetic, you know, couple who've had this baby, is just, we need to take a bigger picture. And so it's a societal thing that we don't support breastfeeding women. There's women who feel that they can't go out into society and feed. And then they're just bombarded by mixed comments from the people they love and they trust. And they, you know, we are sort of, as mums, it's difficult sometimes to, we talk so much about listening to your instinct, but when you are hearing mixed messages and you don't feel safe, whether it's birth or breastfeeding outside with your friends, and you're the only one breastfeeding at 4 months, you can see why it would be a difficult thing. And it's really taboo. And what we see is also countries where the breast is the most sexualized. So say in Britain, when did we get rid of page 3 girls in the tabloid newspapers? It was only a few years ago.
Not that long ago.
So if no one knows what a page 3 girl is, it was in a tabloid newspaper, and it would be a woman who would be topless on page 3. And that only went maybe 2015, maybe even later. I can remember just going, oh my God, I can't believe this is when this disappears. So boobs are sexualized, and you would have heard, and I heard, oh, my boyfriend doesn't want me to breastfeed, you know, my tits are his. Mm-hmm. And when this is our culture, we actually see that with cultures that have taboos or they're much more sexualized, the US, for example, how do we advertise cars, Victoria's Secrets, all of this, it's sexualized. There's a cartoon that there's this great cartoonist who does breastfeeding cartoons. And he's got this picture of this mum breastfeeding outside a big Victoria's Secrets lingerie store. And there's a picture of a Victoria's Secrets model in a very revealing bra. And she's sitting there just in front on the bench breastfeeding. And you can't see any of her breast. And the security guards come over and say, "I'm sorry, miss, you can't breastfeed anymore." And the funny thing that is also not funny is this actually came true in Texas. And there's a news report about a woman who was doing the same thing. And so it was fine to show a sexualized breast in lingerie, and she was moved on for breastfeeding. We've still got this in society. Mm. So how are women meant to feel? You know, we put it on the women to say, you know, you need to tell people to bugger off, or you need to say, you know, I'm legally allowed to be here and breastfeed my baby. But it's an incredible vulnerable moment in our lives. We're exhausted, and we're actually saying, you know, we're blaming the mum. We're actually not blaming society that shouldn't be telling women to move on. Yet again, we're blaming the woman of that she has to stand up for herself. She has to change herself. She has to do something that society finds acceptable, or she has to have the guts and the balls, having had 3 hours sleep perhaps, to say, piss off. I've got every right to do this, and I'll do it. And there are some women like that, but most of us feel we've never, you know, got our breast out in public or done that. And if everyone in society is feeling that this is not acceptable, most of us are not going to want to do it.
Mm.
So the other thing I think to mention is that there was a really good study. There's a couple, but between 80 and 90% of women who were interviewed said that they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. And so we're seeing these initiation rates that are really high, and we see these drop-off rates, or this introduction of formula and then a cessation or a stopping of breastfeeding early on. But when we look at the research that's looking at women's thoughts and feelings, which is incredibly important, we see that around 80% of women, they didn't want to stop. But for some, there was some reason that made them stop before they wanted to. And that's what's really sad. And that's where this is a societal thing. It's not the individual midwife. It's not the individual woman. And this is also the thing around guilt and mum guilt. And there are so many compounding factors that cause breastfeeding to be incredibly hard in the first few days for a lot of people, whether it's soreness, and I will come back to that, but we need to be looking at this on a much larger societal health ministry type of level of support, because, you know, the money also, if we look just at the maternity system within the hospitals, most of the money doesn't go on the postnatal ward. It was always called the Cinderella service. And it's always short-staffed, and it's not acute care, but it is. This is vital. And, you know, women suffer incredible amounts of deep grief and sadness, and some of them will suffer trauma from the fact that they weren't able to breastfeed, just like the fact that perhaps some women are not able to have the birth experience that they wanted. And this needs to be raised up as well and discussed, because there's deep-seated hurt. And as a lactation consultant helping women, I would often get their mothers saying and telling me their story, just like you would get people saying their birth story from 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that brings me back to sore nipples, which is really important to talk about, because we often hear, if you're doing breastfeeding right, it shouldn't be painful. But we all have different breasts. And as we said, not all of us have had someone sucking on them 10 times a day for 3 days in a row. And I don't advise that as preparation or the brushes or anything else. But we will see that soreness, as I said, is around sort of between 70% or 30 and 70% is reported, and that's without damage. It's just, in inverted commas, soreness. And what we see is that peaks around day 3 to day 5, and it tends to subside by around day 7. So if there is some soreness, and women will describe this differently because we all experience pain differently as well, and sensations differently, and we all have different types of elasticity in our nipples, we have different shaped breasts, the baby's had a different type of birth and so might be attaching differently. Some women will describe mild pain and some women will describe extreme pain. Now, women who are describing extreme pain, I definitely want them, or severe pain, I definitely want those women to have much more support. If there is just, again, just, it's not just, but there, if there is some pain without damage and everything else seems to be well, and there has been a midwife or a breastfeeding specialist who has watched your feed and it seems to be going well, then it's probably the fact that there is a frequency of feeding, and also both you and the baby are learning. So not every feed's going to be a perfect attachment, because the biggest reason that we get sore nipples, there's a multitude of potential reasons, but the number one factor for damage or soreness is the baby isn't attached well or correctly or deep enough or in the right position. So it means that the nipple is probably sitting quite at the beginning of the, at the front of the mouth, and not deep enough, and the baby's more nipple sucking. I mean, it's called breastfeeding for a reason. So they should have some of the areola, the breast tissue, in their mouth. And the nipple sits between the hard and soft palate. And so there will be, for most women, a certain amount of discomfort. And that's important to know. We see that there's around about 50%, though, which is still high, who are having damage to the nipples. So this doesn't mean, and this is what's happening because this is the type of services that we have and this is the resources that we have, is they're limited on a postnatal ward, or even with home visits, you get to see one feed, but you're doing 12 feeds a day and you're exhausted. And, you know, when it's at night and you don't want to put the light on, you might not see that the baby's not well attached. And so it's a learning phase and that takes time. But if someone's getting damage, then they absolutely need to be seen by someone who can help support the breastfeeding, or they need to be referred on to someone who can support their breastfeeding, because damage, and if they keep getting damage, not only does the nipple get incredibly painful and sore, it can bleed, but what that means is if the baby is not attaching well, they're actually not draining the milk effectively. So then we have two other problems, which means the baby's hungry, so then it feeds more frequently. So then you've got this baby wanting to feed every 45 minutes, every hour, not satisfied, and you've already got nipples that are making you grit your teeth and curl your toes. I mean, it's so simple to see why women feel they have no other choice than to use formula. And I hate it when we say women give up. No one gives up. Yeah. They have no other choice. And often we see breastfeeding as very black or white. You breastfeed or you bottle feed. There's a multitude of things that we might do in between as a stopgap, and tools we might use to get someone to the point where they're exclusively breastfeeding. And that's why it's important to see someone who's got a greater knowledge in breastfeeding. So if we've got sore nipples, you then get more frequent feeds. So then you get more damage. But then you've got a baby who's not draining correctly. So then you've got a baby who's losing weight. So then we get someone who then comes in and says, oh, your baby's losing weight. And we plant more seeds of doubt. And then we introduce supplement, formula, or pumping as well. And so then she's triple feeding because she's breastfeeding, she's pumping, she's topping up with any express breast milk, and she's having to use formula. And then we've introduced a bottle and a teat probably into that baby's mouth, which may or may not make a difference depending on the baby. Other thing is then we've got a breast that is making milk, hopefully, but it's not being drained efficiently. And so then we've got the possibility of blockages and mastitis.
Yeah. So it's like the cascade of intervention, but the cascade of, you know, not dealing with a small issue just ends up with a complete schmozzle.
And we wonder why women are at their absolute wits' ends, and there's women who describe their nipple pain worse than the labor. And they cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel. And women sit there almost with silent tears because they are in so much pain in their breast, in their heart, and in their head, because they're watching their baby lose weight. And all they want to do is provide it with their milk from their breast. And they may have been on this roller coaster also of seeing people who are not trained. So unfortunately, most doctors have had none or perhaps 4 hours training as a student because we don't see infant feeding as important, even though we're actually meant to breastfeed, if we can, exclusively for 6 months and keep it in our diet for 2 years and beyond. That doesn't mean 10 times a day, but human beings would naturally wean anywhere from around 2.5 years to six. The same with apes. Like we breastfeed a long time for a reason, yet our culture and our support systems, and yet we don't train our medical teams. There's no specialist for lactology. You know, you've got oncology, you've got radiology, that's not doctors, but you've got ophthalmology. I'm trying to think of all the ologies now. I'm thinking Maureen Lipman in that advert from the 90s when she went, "Oh, you've got an ology." We don't, like, as a lactation consultant, I'm a midwife and a lactation consultant. So I have a specialist knowledge, but I'm not a doctor. I can't prescribe in most countries. I don't have that extra knowledge. And it's a bit like saying, well, we've got midwives and we don't have obstetricians. There are definitely times when I need a specialist to consult with and work as a team to support that woman. And we don't have this specialist. We have breast surgeons who maybe have to work with some of the women I see because they may have an abscess. Luckily, but also terribly, only 3% of mastitis develop into an abscess. But you've got breast surgeons who actually then say to the woman, oh, you have to stop breastfeeding, which is also not based in the evidence. Now, some women will find it very challenging for a multitude of reasons why they need to stop breastfeeding or feel that they want to, if that happens. And that's quite understandable. But you've got a whole medical profession who have not been trained on breastfeeding. So that includes GPs. And there was an interesting piece of research that was done in Australia, actually, several years ago. And they looked at GPs, and I think it was around 40%, 45%, but it's a long time ago and I'm pulling this out from the recesses of my brain here. And they looked at GPs and the advice they give, and around about 40% of them give advice on breastfeeding based on their own personal knowledge or that of what they've seen their partner breastfeed. Wow. Now, if you went for any other reason to a doctor and they said, oh, do you know what? I had a broken arm once. I rubbed it with cucumber slices. Yeah, worked for me. Go home and try that. It just wouldn't. How is this allowed? How is it allowed that we can give this information to women that is not based in evidence and is based on someone's experience? And actually, women often, if they're at home and they maybe haven't, they're in that period between seeing the maternal child health nurse or the health visitor and the midwife's discharged them, and they run into problems, which mostly happen in the first 2 to 4 weeks, and they see their GP. And perhaps their GP is wonderful, and there are some amazing GPs out there. But then they run into someone who says, maybe just give a bit of formula because it sounds like you're feeding too frequently and that baby's feeding 10 times a day.
Yep.
And we see why we have, I mean, this is just one part of the reason why it's bloody difficult. It's bloody difficult. And it's not on an individual person's, it's no one's fault. It's the whole society. We need to change from top down, actually, because midwives want to help women. GPs want to help women. You know, we go into this to help, but the knowledge and the support isn't there. And then women feel at a point where they're in so much distress, there is so much anxiety and postnatal depression's creeping in. And we do know that breastfeeding helps prevent postnatal depression or helps reduce it. But if a woman is anxious and the effects of the breastfeeding are leading to depression, we know that that can exacerbate it. So it's a bit of a chicken and an egg type thing of knowing how long to persevere.
Is there anything that we've missed or that you feel we need to?
I mean,
I'm sure we'll revisit this again.
Yeah, I mean, there's just,
because it's huge.
It's huge. And I think that's the thing, is we can often think that, you know, breastfeeding is simple and not complex, and it's just about sticking a baby on. I can remember friends years and years ago being like, why do you have to do a lactation course? Like, doesn't the baby just latch, you know, stick itself on the boob and suck? And you know, I got asked that, it's been 15 years now since I've become a lactation consultant. And back in the UK, I was asked, why would you do that course? And even myself, I mean, I was running a breastfeeding support drop-in, and I thought, oh, I've got to do the lactation course because it helped me get a job in Australia. And I embarked on the course, and it was a bit like, oh, I didn't know a lot. Oh. I think the takeaway is, if you're working with women, don't be frightened to seek advice from someone who's more knowledgeable in this area, and also watch, go and watch what they do and how they do it. If you're a mum who's had a baby, don't be frightened to seek advice, and don't be frightened to seek a second opinion if it doesn't sit right. Try and listen to your instinct and your gut, which is very difficult when you've just given birth for some women. And don't wait till the last minute of like, I actually can't bear to put my baby on for another feed, because at that point, it's really difficult for me as a lactation consultant to even make any changes, because I can't help you put the baby on the breast. We sort of got to wait. And so seeking support early is really important. And skin to skin contact is so, so beneficial. It's not a nice to do. It's part of the treatment or my prescription of wellness and getting breastfeeding sorted. And it does solve so many problems. It's lush, and it helps to calm us down. And that's really important too.
Yeah. So basically start out well would be a physiological birth with no disruption in terms of, you know, medications, instruments. So you've got a healthy, well mother and baby, skin to skin, uninterrupted for days and weeks. You can still skin to skin a baby, you know, weeks, months later. It's lovely to have a baby on your skin. And just remember, we're mammals. You know, this baby needs to smell and taste and not have the perfumes, and not just, you know, treat women like humans, human animals, and babies like humans.
Human monkeys. Be a monkey.
Human monkeys. An ape, actually.
Be an ape. Yes, you are correct. It's the ape family. Whether you like it or not, be an ape, because tell you what, they don't have bassinets. They don't make a nest for their baby. They carry their babies around.
They carry them around and they feed them as much as they need to.
I'm really sorry. Yep. The ape society, we have quite low fat milk. It's just how we're designed. So we're not foxes and tigers that have high fat milk and can just bugger off for 6 hours and leave our pups in the den. We are apes, and our babies need frequent feeding. and I can't change it, sorry. But that's the way it is. We're apes. Just have your cocoon. And if you haven't listened to the episode with Sophie, go back and listen to it and share it with anyone you know who's pregnant, because she talked so beautifully about just that postnatal first few weeks. Mm. Just so beautiful.
And I think another really important takeout, I'm thinking of, like, you know,
takeout. Oh, I'm hungry now.
Indian takeout. I'm thinking dinner. Is that whole awareness that this is not, it's not the individual woman that's at fault when things don't work. It's a massive cultural, societal, you know, that's where the problems are, is in the lack of support that women have, the lack of understanding culturally about what it is to feed a baby. Normal baby behaviors, what's normal for a baby? It's not normal for a baby to sleep through the night and to feed every 3 hours on the clock through the day. That's not normal. And yet that's what women are seeing and hearing, and well-meaning relatives, as you were saying, you know, putting and planting those little seeds of doubt. So it's no wonder, you know, it's almost a surprise that women actually manage to breastfeed.
I know.
Within the, you know, the culture that we have, where we mess the birth up, we interfere with that, you know, mammal bonding at the beginning, and then we tell them that they're not doing it right continually. You know, after that, it's more of a question of how do any women manage to do it?
I know. And any achievement is bloody amazing and awesome if they can. And it is, yes, it's all of that. It's on such a bigger level. And if anyone's, and the thing is, what we're talking about here isn't just, it's for everybody who has had this experience. And midwives have had different experiences, and doulas, and anyone who works in this field. And we carry that deep guilt. There is no guilt. You're quite right.
And as care providers, we need to deal with that, because you do, you know, you see it. I mean, I can remember doing a lecture for nursing students, and then I wasn't allowed to do with them again because I'd upset them all, because I talked about the benefits of physiological birth and breastfeeding, and it massively triggers women who didn't who didn't breastfeed themselves for whatever reason. And it's, you know, easier in some respects for them to then say, well, I didn't do it and my baby's all right, and I need to keep reinforcing that to myself, rather than be compassionate to themselves and say, look, I didn't do it. And maybe given the information now and the support, I could have done it. And I'm going to do that for these women that I care for, and make sure that they, if they choose not to, it's not because they didn't get the information and the support that they needed. It's, you know, it's trying to reframe that instead of continually picking at that wound and looking at what, you know, you did as a mother, which is why it's so much easier when you haven't been a mother, because you haven't got all of that. But, you know, we do that as midwives. We look back and, you know, there's a whole host of things I would have done completely differently now, knowing what I know. And but I didn't. And you just have to move on with that, because it's not actually about you and your experiences. It's about this woman who's in front of you.
Absolutely. I can't believe you were banned from doing the talk. I actually prefaced
my talks.
Well,
I wasn't technically banned. I just wasn't invited back the next year.
You were banned, Rachel. You were banned. Oh, it's been lovely to talk to you about boobs, breastfeeding.
It's lovely. I've learned lots and then relearned lots too. And I'm going to go and look at my textbooks now.
Oh, we'll find a picture and we'll do the comparisons. That's how I feel every time I come on with you. It's just, it's so lush, because it's just like you're a walking textbook and I get to listen without having to read it. Excellent.
Yeah, same. Dude, we're doing our own CPD here. We should actually be documenting this for our CPD hours.
Oh my God. I reckon we can. I'm not sure we could send it in with all the fucks and shits and buggers on the podcast, but you never know.
I reckon we could. And just a rant about CPD, continued professional development for those people who are listening. Like, this is an ACM-centric rant, so apologies.
Also, what is ACM? Because we do have people not in Australia listening to us. Woohoo! Shout out to the non-Aussies.
Australian College of Midwives. So Australian College of Midwives offer education, and it's great, and they offer then CPD points. But then there's this confusion that you need to have CPD points.
Yep.
in order to meet your registration requirements for the 20 hours of CPD. Yeah. When you don't, you can use those CPD points, but it's actually 20 hours of CPD, not points. So you could listen to one of our podcasts and write some notes and have a conversation with someone, document that. That's actually CPD. So it's about recording your learning. It doesn't have to be a certified learning activity. You could read a journal article and write a reflection. That would be a CPD activity. So just wanted to put it out there because it does my head in when people constantly ask about courses. Oh, but does that have CPD points? Or yes, it does. It has CPD hours, which is what you need when you re-register.
Correct.
Hours, not points. Rant over, soapbox tucked away.
Brilliant.
Done.
We hadn't had a rant, so it's perfect. That's the perfect way to end the podcast.
No, you know what else we haven't had?
What? A song?
We haven't had nuggets. We haven't had nuggets and we haven't had goosebumps.
Well, it's because I was talking and I was having my own goosebumps, but I couldn't talk about it. I was having sadness, actually. Did I give you a nugget of gold? Or was it a nugget of
shit? Give me a nugget of gold.
Well, there you go, folks. The early days of breastfeeding. Covered a couple of topics there. Rachel gave me a few of the hard questions, but hopefully you enjoyed. As always, we love to say a huge thank you for all of your support. Every episode is blowing us away, really, at how many more people are listening and getting involved, sending us messages. And we ask you, I know every episode, can you go and write us a review? But you know what a review does on Apple? It gets us seen. And also, this gets that message out. And we want more people in the cauldron. We've got a massive cauldron. So I'm going to leave you on that note until the next episode. But as always, here's the bloopers.
You know, I was thinking was we have to eventually do YouTube, the YouTubes of our recording.
I'll have to put clothes on then.
People will want to watch. Nah, because I can't see your bra.
I'm sure people don't want to see us.
You'd be surprised. No, because
why would you watch a YouTube of this when you could just listen to it while you're doing something?
That's what I always think. But people are doing podcast YouTubes and they get different type of audience. We might need to just make things a little better for me.
I was going to say, I'm in the dark with no clothes on. And
as the winter comes, and then I've just got the glint of your glasses with no light on because you never put it on. That'd be brilliant YouTube viewing. Okay, maybe not.
And you've got your washing behind you.
Well, it's just many different rugs and scarves that are fat enough to be a sound barrier. I was going to buy one and I thought, why? This works.
But not for YouTube, it doesn't work. What is?
Your sound quality is way shitter than mine. So why would I improve mine anymore? Well, you sit in a massive room. It's echoey. I mean, you look beautiful for YouTubes. Anyway, let's do this podcast.
All right, tell us about the boobs. Never mind that.
Is that it?
So, today... Hang on.
Radio voice.
Bing, bong, bing. Hi, listeners. Today... Oh, I need to do the geezer voice. I can't because it'll be really bad. Today, I'm talking to Katie, innit? We're talking about all things getting breastfeeding started. So, Katie, did that sound cockney?
Yeah. I'm going to say yes.
I can do cockney if I'm singing. I just can't do it talking.
Oh, can you sing like Eliza Doolittle? Can you sing the intro for...
Maybe it's because I'm a Londoner that I love London Town. See?
I love it.
And as you know, my Nancy Oompa-pa, Oompa-pa is my signature tune.
It is your signature tune. We haven't allowed the listeners to have this until now. So this is like a present for the hardcore listeners.
But we would need YouTube for that because there's a dance that goes with that one. So that would need to be.
There's several YouTube interpretive dances that that belong to Rachel Reed.
We could do that. We could do that for the Christmas edition, the Oompa-pa one.
We've just passed Christmas. It's bloody March.
Well,
you're preparing it now. Oh my God, it's going to be an extravaganza of a musical. We need to take each. Oh my God, take the songs that exist, change the words, add in a bit about vulvas, rites of passage. We can have one on menarche, menopause. Go through the whole thing. Forget the vagina monologues. It's a Midwest culture musical. So excited. You can do the choreography. We might get someone else to sing the songs.
No, I'll be singing the song. As long as I can sing in a Cockney accent, we'll be all right.
Right, can I sing in a Geordie accent? Be a bit Catherine Cookson. Go up north. And you can come down south and we can meet somehow as midwives. Oh my God, that's actually what happened. We tell the story of our meeting. This is it. Christmas musical, everyone.
Nugget of poop. Poop nuggets.
Poop nugget. That's going in the musical. Just saying.
I think this is serious. I think if we could, you know, maybe
if anyone's
should, like,
out there
some time to actually,
who is a musical director, choreographer, voice coach, because we might need that, Rachel. But I'm going to sing the theme tune. I'm going to do the theme tune. Is that Little Britain?
It is Little Britain.
And we want to act in it. Oh, God, no, that's making me think of Bitty. Oh! Rips me out.
Perfect ending. If you don't know what Bitty is, go and look it up. Little Britain Bitty. They'll ruin your day.
Bitty, mummy, Bitty. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, The Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough, at times, quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.